Support for WPR comes from Steep & Brew, offering Cafe Fair socially responsible organic coffee. Cafe Fair supports environmentally sustainable practices and roasts coffee in a solar-powered facility. CafeFair.com. Support also comes from Cressa Madison, a commercial real estate firm that represents only tenants, never landlords. Cressa's tenant-only representation means lease negotiations free from conflicts of interest. More at Cressa.com. Cressa, the tenant's advantage.
It's the morning show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We live in a world with the promise that technology will make our lives better. But will that ever be more than a promise? Are humans more complex and nuanced for smart machines to understand? That's the question Meredith Broussard explores in her book, Artificial Intelligence, How Computers Misunderstand the World. Meredith, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
We also, of course, want to hear from callers on this. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Where do you see advancement in technology improving lives? Maybe it's in medicine or work systems. Do you have an HVAC system that you can control with your phone? Or do you have a robot vacuum? What's going to make you a believer in technology? And should you be a believer? Meredith, some people hope for a future that seems magical. Personally, I want to be able to apparate. I don't know if technology will ever let me do that. But, you know, a lot of people are just looking for the mundane. The laundry's done, the grass is mowed without lifting a finger. Should we be quick to embrace this hands-off world?
You know, I think apparating sounds like it would be a lot of fun.
Wouldn't it?
Yeah. You know, the other thing that I would really like to have is that that machine from Star Trek that, like, makes your food appear.
Yes.
Magically, so then I would never have to make dinner again.
And it would be nutritious, yes.
And it would be nutritious, and, you know, somebody else would take care of all the details. Yes, these are wonderful fantasies. But one of the things that I do in my book, Artificial Unintelligence, is I talk about the inner workings and the outer limits of tech, and I talk about how it's really important to keep in mind what is imaginary and what is real and what is practical. So one of the things I talk about with my son, because we actually talk about apparating quite a lot, because, you know, that's what young people talk about.
Right.
And he has this whole theory about how what happens if you apparate into the middle of a wall? Like, what if you get your target wrong and you're
right.
just, like, stuck in a wall?
Right. And what is his theory?
His theory is that it would happen an awful lot. That people would
So now I'm totally fascinated. How do I get out of the wall? I'm going to apparate someday. So how do I get out of the wall if I get stuck in the middle of a wall?
Well,
he hasn't figured that out yet.
Yeah, we actually have, like, extremely long conversations about this, and it's pretty fun. But no, there's no apparating.
Okay, fine. That's the problem. So what made you, you worked in tech, and what made you look at and see a discrepancy between the ideas people had, which could drive them to do things that seemingly are impossible, and the limitations of the physical world?
So I've been programming since I was 11 years old.
Wow.
I learned to program when I was a little girl. I can program in, you know, more than a dozen different programming languages. So I've been doing this for a very long time. And I looked around one day and I realized that I had been hearing the same promises about technology for decades. So every time there's a new technological innovation, people start saying, oh, this is really the one that is going to work. This is going to be the game changer. You know, right now, it's Bitcoin that people are really excited about. Before, it was social media. You know, people are also really hyped about voice interfaces now. And so when you look at the rhetoric, you actually hear the same promises repeated over and over again. And we've been in the digital era for long enough that if we do truly look back, we can recognize that very few of these promises have been realized. So I started to look critically at the way that we talk about technology and the way that people imagine a technological future. And I started to look at, well, how is that being used to manipulate people? And how is that blind faith in technology a camouflage for discrimination?
Okay, so those are two things I want to dig into. Manipulating people. How and why are people being manipulated?
So one of the things I argue against in the book is an idea I called techno-chauvinism, which is the belief that technology is always the highest and best solution. And the thing is, the technology is ultimately math. When you're doing anything with a computer, ultimately you are you're doing mathematics on some level. And we can't actually solve social problems with math. And so trying to solve social problems with technology is trying to solve social problems with math, and that just doesn't work. So I think the answer is to get more literate about what is actually happening inside the computer, what can computers do really well, what can't they do really well, and how can we make that work better so that humans and technology can be used together to make solutions to social problems.
So are you saying that we can never have technology that will mow our lawns for us, that will clean our houses well? Or are you just saying that there are some barriers that we need to get over?
I'm saying that it is reasonable to do some things autonomously with technology, and then other things need to be designed as human-in-the-loop systems, right? So autonomous systems are ones that operate entirely on their own, and human-in-the-loop systems are ones where the human is an integral part of the system. So the Roomba vacuum is a really good example of this. The Roomba works really well some of the time, but if you have a pet, then you know that there are some dangers of using a Roomba, because if your pet leaves something disgusting on the floor, the Roomba is not going to recognize that as something disgusting, and it's going to spread it all over your house.
Okay, so there's got to be some measure of human intelligence. Can that ever be built into that Roomba or the artificial intelligence?
I mean, it's about context. I mean, could you build a Roomba that identifies disgusting obstacles on the floor? Well, I mean, you could build in some object recognition, but then you need a training data set of disgusting things that pets leave on the floor.
Right.
And I mean, I don't know anybody who's going to build that. Like, that sounds revolting.
Right. So you talked about discrimination also. So how does this work in terms of discrimination?
So one of the ways that that this works regarding discrimination is that machine learning algorithms discriminate by default. So the way that machine learning works is a machine learning model looks at the world as it is. It takes in training data and says, "All right, this is what this data looks like, and then I'm going to make decisions based on what this data looks like, and I'm going to just re-implement all of the things that I see in this data set." But the world as it is not an equal world. All right, so looking at the world as it is and then replicating it does not get us to the world as it should be.
Mm-hmm.
So let's think about hiring. So you have a whole bunch of resumes, and the machine learning model looks at it and says, "Oh, okay, who are the people who are likely to succeed? All right, well, I'm just going to take out the people who have, say, the college degrees that are the fanciest, and I'm just going to ignore all the other people."
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not fair. But you can't see that it's not fair because it's happening inside the algorithm, which is opaque, right? So machine learning models are not explainable right now. And so if you believe that doing something with computers is better than doing something with humans, then you'll just look at this algorithm and you'll say, oh, well, the algorithm did it. The algorithm is just neutral. It's more fair than humans, but it's actually not.
Because humans into the algorithm that education at a better school is an important factor. Yes?
Right. They put it in consciously or unconsciously. And you and I know that it's much more nuanced than that.
So one of the things that I watch robotics a lot and robotics competitions. And one of the things that strikes me is robots can't do simple things like robots can't really bend down that easily and swoop something up. If a robot finds an object in its path, it really depends on how the robot is built as to whether and how easily that robot can go around that object. They're fun competitions, but one of the things that kind of strikes me when I see this is how rudimentary we really are in terms of building robots.
Absolutely, yes. One of my favorite genres of online videos is robot fail videos. So you kind of see robots like trying to walk upstairs and falling over backwards.
Oh, yeah,
or robots
trying to
like open doors and, you know, pulling the handle off of the door. So robot technology, AI technology is not really as advanced as we would like to imagine. So one of the things that I do in the book is I take an up close look at, all right, how well does this stuff really work? And I get into the guts of it. So I look at the training data. I look at the algorithms. I look at the scholarly research. I look at the popular coverage. And I talk about what's real and what's imaginary. And I talk about the things that are really fun about, say, robot technology, but also the ways that, you know, we really should not rely on this because it's going to let us down.
Right. We are talking about the limits of technology this morning. How do you think about technology? Is innovation good or does it come with drawbacks? Should we push computers to do more and more just because we can? And actually, how much can computers do? We'll talk more about this in a moment. It's The Morning Show. The Morning Show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're talking about why technology sometimes seems like your clueless cousin and whether it will ever grow up to be the smartest thing you know. Also, what does smart mean? Robots can do a trajillion calculations, but getting them to bend down and pick up a pencil is a feat that makes engineers weep. We want to hear from you this morning, 1-800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Sometimes we are fast to embrace technology, Meredith, and sometimes there are a lot of people who don't want to deal with technology at all. Is there a happy medium?
Oh, I really hope that there's a happy medium. One of the things that I talk about in the book is I talk about using the right tool for the task. And so sometimes the right tool for the task is absolutely using a computer or using a phone or using a tablet. And then other times the right tool for the task is paper. I think we've gotten into this this weird thing over the past couple of decades where people are snobbish about using paper. doing something on my phone is better than writing it down on a piece of paper. Mm-hmm. And I just, whenever that comes up, I'm like, why on earth would you have a bias toward like a phone over a piece of paper? Like, that seems ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Like, all you need to do is write it down. And it doesn't really matter how you write it down as long as it gets you to, as long as you get the task done. And then also, when it comes to education, this comes up a lot. So for a long time, I had students who would say, "Oh, I really want to read this book on my Kindle, and I'm going to get all of my textbooks electronically." But it turns out that in the classroom, that's not a really good strategy, mm-hmm. because in the classroom, a lot of the time, what we do is we sit around a table and we talk about a text. And the point is to be there together in the room communicating. And so the Kindle actually gets in the way because it's very hard to flip on a Kindle. It's much easier to flip in a hardcover book when you're mm-hmm. sitting around a table with people. Mm-hmm. My students were always like running out of power on their Kindle, and then they would like need to plug it in. And so it just added all of these layers of complexity that were totally unnecessary.
But there has been a move recently to say we need to make kids better, and kids are dealing with tech. They have devices all the time. So let's give them Kindles to learn, or let's give them computers that they can take home. Is this a bad thing?
So it is obviously a good thing for kids to learn technology. There's an organization called CS for All. And another organization called AI for All that are doing great work in integrating basic computer science into K-12 education. So I'm all for that. However, when we look back at all of the initiatives to replace current education with online education, or replace books with computers, all of those efforts have failed.
Hmm.
And it's all of these mundane reasons. Like in schools, they don't have enough plugs in the classrooms to support all of the electricity that a laptop cart needs. Right? And like kids lose things, they break things all the time.
Right.
Schools don't have enough tech support to keep the Wi-Fi working to support the demands of hundreds of people with multiple devices each. So if we were able to fix all of those problems simultaneously, then like maybe it would work. But there's always something, and none of these efforts have worked. So I think it's time to stop saying, "Oh yeah, we're just going to replace in-person education with technology and it'll just work." And we just need to be a little more careful about it.
We need to maybe update our schools so that it can handle the technology.
Oh, God, our schools need so many updates. We need better school funding. We need to pay our teachers more. We need to spend a lot more money on schools.
So one of the things you talked about in your book is opioids and other illegal drugs, and how that is affected by tech. Talk to me about that.
So there's a lot of fraud that happens online, and online is basically like an open-air drug marketplace, and that is not getting us toward a better world.
In terms of I'm kind of, obviously I'm not online trading in drugs, so how does this actually work?
So basically like you can buy drugs online, and you can find a drug connection online. And in Reddit, for example, like there was a heroin forum where like when you were traveling, you could post on this forum and be like, "Oh, who, how can I get a connection in this new city?"
And how is that legal?
Well, because the people who invented the ideas that we all believe in nowadays about technology and society are actually like a very small and homogeneous group of people. And they really like having this this world of their version of free trade. And they really like drugs. And they don't really like regulation. So they've built a system where the rule of law is not enforced. And they've told everybody, "Oh yeah, the internet is different. Like the internet, cyberspace doesn't need police. We're just going to like police ourselves." And that is obviously not true. And yet that's how we all act. Like, we all pretend that, oh, it's not a big deal that, like, you can get a heroin connection on Reddit. It's a big deal.
Yeah. Meredith Broussard is an assistant professor at New York University, where she teaches data journalism, and she has written about artificial intelligence and the limits thereof. We want to take your calls this morning, 1-800-642-1234. What do you think about artificial intelligence? Do you own a Roomba, for instance, and do you want to own an Alexa? What are the things in your life that are driven by artificial intelligence, that are driven by machines? What is your dream in terms of what you can do? Is it magic? Can it happen? And should it happen? This is the Ideas Network. So, Meredith, we're talking here about artificial intelligence. Some people love their Alexa. Some people talk to it all the time. It's kind of a companion. What is your perspective on that kind of stuff?
I think it's important to think about what is AI and what isn't AI. So we kind of lump together a lot of things under the category of artificial intelligence. One of the things I talk about in the book is the way that artificial intelligence is a subfield of computer science, the way that algebra is a subfield of mathematics. And machine learning, which is the most popular kind of AI right now, is kind of what people mean when they talk about AI in business right now. But there are actually other kinds of AI besides machine learning. You know, there's expert systems, there's natural language generation. That's what people use to do automated writing, robot reporting. Mm-hmm. So there's this linguistic confusion around AI. And the kinds of AI that we have right now are narrow AI. They are all mathematical. And the Hollywood stuff is general AI. So general AI is like the, you know, the robot that becomes sentient and tries to take over the world and like kills everybody in order to make paperclips.
Right.
Right. Like that kind of fantasy stuff. So general AI is imaginary and narrow AI is real. And in the book, I talk about the limits of narrow AI, because when you look really close at it, it becomes obvious that, yes, a narrow AI is math. And of course, there are things that we cannot do with math.
There are things we cannot do with math. I don't know. I tend to think that math is something that just needs to be discovered more, that we can do anything with math. No?
I mean, there are fundamental limits to mathematics. Like, there are things that we don't know. And then also, like, there are things that you wouldn't try and do with math, like love, for example.
Okay. There are people out there who think that there is an equation for love.
Those people are wrong.
Okay. We do have some callers right now. Well, actually, don't have the names of those callers yet. So I want to look at autonomous vehicles. This is the new artificial intelligence that that we're talking about now. They're being tested out in various cities. There was one person who was killed in Arizona. And I'm not really sure the details of why that happened. Is this the wave of the future, or is this going to go away?
I think that autonomous vehicles are a terrible idea. I think they're not safe. They're not in any way as safe as most people probably imagine. They're not as close to being just all the reports of, oh, autonomous vehicles are coming soon. They're overblown. And when you look, actually, people have been saying, oh, they're coming soon, oh, they're coming soon, for years and years and years. So I first rode in an autonomous vehicle in a self-driving car in 2007. Hmm. And that was it was part of the DARPA Grand Challenge, which was this government-funded initiative to have a competition to build self-driving cars. And people were saying back then, oh, they're coming soon, they're coming soon. It'll definitely be on the market in a couple of years. And, you know, here we are 11 years later, and they're being tested on the road, and people are dying.
Right.
So I think that's actually pretty good evidence that we should not move toward this as a society. We have somebody who died in the self-driving in an accident where she was hit by a self-driving Uber in Arizona. We have at least two cases of people who died in crashes using the Tesla autopilot self-driving feature. It just doesn't work as well as you'd imagine.
Do you think that it would be safer if self-driving vehicles were like driving around airports, transporting things, driving around a factory, transporting things, not outside transporting people?
Yeah, that's a great use of the technology. In a very limited situation where it's not like a two-ton killing machine like roaming the streets where innocent children are playing. In a factory, I don't know if you watch The Americans, but there's like a mail delivering robot in The Americans that drives itself around. That I get a big kick out of that. I'm also enthusiastic about farming applications.
Oh, so
self-driving tractors.
Self-driving tractors. That's interesting. We've got Heather from Erin, Wisconsin. Heather, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I kind of had two points as you just listened to a little bit more, too. You know, the dream for artificial intelligence and the way I think that it can help us more is if we let it enhance us and make us better people. But I see so much of the technology and all this stuff just making us more lazy, less interactive, more, I don't want to say bad, but bad's the word that comes to my mind, is bad human beings. We forget about the interaction and the way we can be better people. You were talking earlier about the education, and I just think there's so much technology at our children's fingertips today, and we're not taking their education to the next level of it. We're still crippled by an archaic education system that's not taking education or the technology to the next level to help us be better students. One of my beefs is, man, if I won the lottery, I would love to go to like Finland and just figure out what are they doing with their educational system that the kids are so much better educated.
Right.
They utilize technology. We're like in this rut, and technology is not helping us. So if it doesn't help us and it hinders us, I don't see the benefit of so much of it in our society. Automated cars killing people. Why? We can't drive our cars anymore?
Okay. Yeah. These are great questions, Heather. Meredith, she brings up the question of how much technology should replace things in our lives and how much it should just enhance our lives. Where do you come down on that?
So I would love to use technology to enhance our lives. I think that when we do blindly say, oh, yeah, let's just put in more technology just for the sake of putting in more technology, it allows things like sexism and discrimination and fraud to flourish. One of the things I read about in the book is alternate ways that we could use technology to enhance schools. So, for example, we could use AI to make sure that every kid in every classroom has all of the materials that they need in order to succeed. You know, they need books and they need computers and they need pencils and, you know, in the cafeteria they need tater tots. And so we could use technology very easily to make sure that the school budget has enough money to buy the pencils and the tater tots, and we could use inventory control systems to make sure that all the books are in the classrooms where they need to be. That would be a really great use of technology to enhance our lives.
But technology can't make the budget bigger.
Well, people need to make the budget bigger.
And also, you are a woman of color, and you've been in technology all your life. You've mentioned a couple of times that technology can be discriminatory. What did you find personally as you have been going through the technological world? And when you bring these things up, what is the response?
Well, so everything that they say about the social forces edging women and people of color out of STEM careers, it's all true.
Right.
And I have been dealing with this my whole life. I was a computer science major at Harvard, and I dropped out of computer science because of the sexism. I was one of six women who were undergraduate computer science majors, and I only knew two of the other women. I couldn't even find the others.
Wow.
So it is incredibly isolating and alienating, and I'm really grateful that I had the opportunity to come back to computer science later on in my career. But I think we can't discount how powerful social forces are. So techno-chauvinism, one of the ideas that I read about in the book, has a really healthy dose of sexism and racism inside it. So computer science is a descendant of mathematics in terms of being an academic field, and mathematicians for years have had this attitude that the math matters more than any of the social factors. And so you see this today in things like people saying that tech is a meritocracy, that everybody has an equal chance to succeed, and it's really just about how good is your code. It's not about anything else. Like, that's nonsense. Like, it's about everything. It's about social factors. And it just so happens that, yeah, no, there aren't any women or people of color who really can make it in this meritocracy.
What's interesting to me is that it's about other factors. Are you talking more about what your code does, the result of your code that you need to think about before you just sit down and start coding? Or are you talking about the barriers that stop women and people of color from getting to that computer to write the code in the first place?
So it's, God, it's really complicated. So
yeah, I know.
Of those things all at once. So writing the code is one thing. Learning how to write the code is another thing. Working inside an organization that supports you in writing the code is important. You have to think about the internal politics of the organization. Are you bringing in women and people of color in power roles inside the organization, and what are the power roles? So in a tech company, it's the back-end development roles that are the most powerful. And that's different than in, some other kind of company, like mm-hmm. in a factory. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not necessarily like the back-end technologists who are the ones with the most power. But at a tech company, yes, there's this machismo around back-end technology. And so when you look at the gender balance in a company, you can't just look at how many women and how many men are at a company. You have to look at how many women and men are there and what kind of roles are they being shunted into. So, like, if you only have women working in HR and marketing, well, that's not really making a meaningful dent in the power dynamics.
So give me an idea of piece. Actually, when we come back from this break, what I want from you is an idea of something that was built only from the perspective of a white male, and that may have actually been built differently had it been built from a perspective of a woman or a man of color. We are talking to Meredith Broussard, who is assistant professor at New York University, where she teaches data journalism. She wrote a book about the limits of data journalism, and we are taking your calls, 800-642-1234. We'll get to a couple of calls after this. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're talking about the limits of technology today with Meredith Broussard, who coined the term tech chauvinism and who says we have a long way to go before artificial intelligence even comes close to human intelligence. 1-800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Do you work in data? Have you written programs for machine learning? And how reliable are the systems you create? Meredith, before we broke, we were talking about the differences between what the men who are in charge are writing and what other people who might not be in charge, what they would write. Talk to me about this.
Sure. So one example of kind of male bias being being baked into the design of a product is the Apple Watch, okay, which doesn't come with a period tracker.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, if you were designing for, if you had women running that design team,
right,
and if women were acknowledged as, maybe the primary, primary audience or an audience that matters a lot, maybe you'd have a period tracker as a default on an Apple Watch. And why not have it as the default and make it so that men, who don't need that particular feature have to delete it as opposed to women having to add it?
Interesting. We've got, that is very interesting. Joe from Sturgeon Bay. Joe, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I just wondered if you could talk about the, when you talk about limits of technology, I have an expression which is the disabled technology, which is that every day these smart devices have disabilities that are built into them by the designers who seem to be inventing software and hardware that is so poorly designed that we have to make up for it. And we have these glitches that we use on our calendars and on our word processing, and you just put up with it. And Walt Mossberg, who was with the Journal, said, if we had washers and refrigerators that were so poorly designed, we'd throw them out on the curb. We'd never use them on a day-to-day basis. So that was my comment.
That's actually a great question, Joe. Meredith, we put up with tech. You know, I've got this phone that does everything except sometimes when I'm in certain places actually call people because because it's not connecting well. But yet I paid a lot of money for this phone. Why?
You know, I am so tired of maintaining all of the various technological systems that that govern my life. And I mean, we have all these systems and none of them work well at all. Like, it's just, it's endlessly frustrating. And I'm so tired of it that I feel like, what are we doing? Like, why am I spending so much time maintaining all of these devices in my life when, like, I don't really need the devices? Like, is this actually making my life better? You know, or like you think about how long it takes to like do an expense report. Like it used to be like I would just like take my little receipt and like tape it to a piece of paper and like hand it in. And like now, you know, it takes half an hour to like click all the little boxes on the expense reports. I mean, it's it's mundane things like this, or like signing my kid up for camp. I had to visit the doctor's office twice to get the forms, and then it took me like half an hour to type in every single thing on the piece of paper into the field of the camp documentation application. And it honestly would have been a lot easier if I could just mail in the form that I got from the doctor's
office. That is true, but somebody on the other end then would have had to type that form in. I mean, the time is being saved. It's just not your time.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm okay with somebody having a job.
That is true.
That seems fine to me.
So talk to me about the difference between machine learning and artificial intelligence.
So machine learning is a kind of artificial intelligence. And one of the things I do in the book is I go through what does it actually look like when somebody does machine learning. Because this phrase, machine learning, kind of suggests to me that there's a little brain inside the computer, right? It suggests that the computer is sentient. And an AI researcher I know likes to say that machine learning models are no more sentient than a bowl of noodles, right? So it's a mathematical process. And I take readers through a tutorial of using machine learning to predict which passengers survived the Titanic disaster. So this is a really common tutorial to get students or get beginners familiar with principles of machine learning and principles of data science. And one of the reasons it works really well is because most people are familiar with the Titanic disaster. But if you picture the Titanic in your mind, who's the person who you think of?
Jack.
Yeah, you think of Jack, right? Right. Like, you think about Leonardo DiCaprio,
exactly.
You think about Kate Winslet, you think about the door, and you think, why did Jack have to die? There was plenty of room for
right.
two people on the
exactly.
door. All right, so our Hollywood images of the Titanic are tied up with our memories or imagination of what actually happened. So it's a really good case for looking at what is real and what is imaginary, and how do we build technology for something that's real? And also, what are the limits of that technology? So when you build a machine learning model that predicts who's going to survive the Titanic disaster, you can make a model that has phenomenal accuracy,
mm-hmm.
right? It's a very accurate prediction. But then when you look at it, you see that the factor that influences whether or not somebody survived the Titanic disaster was the passenger class. So first-class passengers survived at a much higher rate than second- or third-class passengers. And that's because the second- and third-class passengers were locked into their hallways, and they weren't permitted to get on the lifeboats.
Right.
All right? Obviously not good. So if we use this machine learning model to, say, predict who's going to survive a current maritime disaster, and we use it to predict how much we should charge somebody for travel insurance, we would end up charging rich people less, because if they have enough money to travel first class, then they're more likely to survive based on this model, and therefore the insurance company doesn't have to charge them as much, which is ridiculous. Like, that's not how we want the world to work. We don't want to discriminate against people who are buying a more economical ticket. Like, that's ridiculous.
So we had a caller, Alicia. She wanted to push back a little bit on the internet as the Wild West. She mm-hmm. says human beings do police themselves and police activities. Is that true? I mean, we're coming off of a time in which Facebook mostly, but also Twitter and YouTube were used in ways that their founders and the people who run them didn't really understand.
Yeah, I mean, small communities generally do a very good job of regulating themselves and policing themselves. Online, the same way that small communities do a good job of policing themselves in the real world. But we do need the rule of law. We do need police, because there is fraud. Like, there are bad people out there, and those bad people are going to use technological systems for their own gain. And so that's exactly what we see happening with Facebook and Cambridge Analytica.
Mm-hmm.
We see a lot of abuse on Twitter. There are all kinds of ways that technological systems are being used for fraud and for malice that we have no idea about.
First of all, you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network, and we are talking about the limits of artificial intelligence and technology. Yet I feel, Meredith, that everyday people can do something to mitigate the risks of this technology. Are we completely helpless, and are we just at the mercy of the people who run the big tech companies?
So one of the things that I want people to take away from my book, Artificial Intelligence, is I want people to take away a sense of empowerment. I want people to learn more about how technology works so that we can say no when we're presented with the idea that we should use technology in a way that is not going to get us toward a better world. Right. So predictive policing, for example, generally not a great idea. Like when
You mean broken windows policing, that kind of thing?
No, the kind of high-tech surveillance policing that ends up – so there's this good book called I'm going to forget the name now. It's by Andrew T. Ferguson. It's about policing and big data. And generally, predictive policing is deployed against poorer communities, communities of color, and it ends up surveilling these communities more. And these are some of our more vulnerable communities, right? And so if you're looking for a crime and you're using these computational methods to look for crime, you're going to find it.
Right.
And you're going to find it at a disproportionately higher rate because you're using these methods to find it.
Right. I see.
Yeah. So it ends up getting out of whack. I don't know if you saw The Wire. But there's a whole season of The Wire that is devoted to looking at CompStat and predictive policing and how it's not fantastic.
So again, what do we do to combat artificial intelligence sort of taking over our lives? How much of it should we have in our lives?
How much technology you have in your life, I think, is really an individual decision. I think that I'm most optimistic about human-in-the-loop systems as opposed to autonomous systems. So autonomous systems are ones that operate completely without human intervention. That's kind of the fantasy of Facebook being self-regulating and having algorithms that just identify fake news and eliminate them. Like, it hasn't worked. Mm-hmm. It's not practical. There are just things that you cannot do. Right, like algorithms cannot autonomously identify fake news and eliminate it. But we can have a human-in-the-loop system that makes things better. Okay, so let's think about humans as valuable. I mean, humans are the point, right? Like the point is not to make to make a world that runs with and for machines. The point is to make a world that runs with and for humans. And so let's think about designing systems that incorporate humans as meaningful in the system. And I think that's going to get us toward a better world.
So Facebook should employ more people to work with the algorithms to police what's going on Facebook.
Yeah.
Okay. Meredith Broussard is an assistant professor at New York University, where she teaches data journalism. She wrote the book, Artificial Intelligence, How Computers Misunderstand the World. It's been a fascinating conversation, Meredith. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
The Morning Show is produced by Colleen Leahy, Brianne Chasso, Chris Molina, Laura Pavin, and Sarah Hopeful. Michael Derringer is our technical director. Keely Boltina is the executive producer. I'm Carrie Kaufman, and this is the Ideas Network.